Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 18-5297, Abdul Razak Ali, detainee appellant versus Donald J. Trump, President of the United States et al. Mr. Cardinal for the appellant, Ms. Swingle for the appellate.
Good morning.
Good morning, and with permission, I've asked for 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. As we stated at the outset of our reply brief, this court's decision in Qasim clearly mandates reversal on both grounds for the district court's decision below. But Qasim does not answer the central question we presented squarely below, whether the protections of the Due Process Clause reach detainees like Ali, who are held for what will soon be 18 years without charge. We believe they do.
Can you speak up a little?
I'm sorry.
I don't know whether the microphone suggested correctly.
Okay. We believe they do. Boumediene applies a functional test familiar from a long line of prior cases to ask whether the application of a constitutional provision abroad would be impracticable and anomalous. The intertwined nature of due process and habeas compels the same answer for both the suspension clause and the due process clause. The conclusion that due process applies at Guantanamo in turn demands that the federal courts ask whether Ali's continued detention into year 18 is consistent with substantive due process in two respects. First, does it shock the conscience? Second, does it serve a continuing, non-punitive purpose that can be demonstrated by clear and convincing evidence? And finally, procedural due process mandates that whatever the legal standard being applied, the courts apply hearsay rules that are consistent with due process or with the due process clause and apply, at this stage of the detentions, a clear and convincing evidence standard.
What did we hold in People's Mujahideen the first go-round? What did this court hold?
In PMOI? I believe the holding in PMOI is that a foreign organization that's designated as a terrorist organization doesn't have a due process right to challenge.
Procedural due process rights.
I guess that's right.
Yeah, but they wanted notice and opportunity to comment. Mm-hmm. And we said that an alien, mm-hmm. whether person or corporation or organization, has no procedural due process rights outside the territory of the United States. What did we hold? What did we hold in Giffrey, in Judge Rogers' opinion?
In Giffrey, I'm not sure I'm familiar with that case. Sorry.
I'll read it to you. The Supreme Court has long held that non-resident aliens who have insufficient contacts with the United States are not entitled to Fifth Amendment protection. Mm-hmm. That was procedural due process.
Mm-hmm. I think the crucial difference here is that for all practical purposes, Ali and the detainees like him are held within the United States. The Supreme Court has twice ruled that Guantanamo is the practical equivalent of the United States.
I think the implication here is, to what extent is this panel bound by its precedent? And therefore, the implication of the question would be that we must reject your procedural due process argument.
Right. Again, I think the key distinction is that these are detainees held at Guantanamo. Again, a place that for all practical purposes is like the United States in every practical sense.
Are you familiar with the 11th Circuit's opinion dealing with detainees at Guantanamo?
The 11th Circuit opinion from 1992, I think so.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the 11th Circuit held that those detainees at Guantanamo were not entitled to the protection of the procedural protection of the due process clause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, let me ask you something. All three of those cases that I just mentioned, the government particularly cites Giffrey, and it cites Mujahideen 1 and Mujahideen 2, and states basically what you agree, that aliens without property or presence in the United States of America are not entitled to due process. Your reply brief does not even cite those cases, let alone try to distinguish them. Mm-hmm. Now you're telling us that you have a distinction. But that's not in your reply brief, and it's not in your topside brief.
Oh, I think it's very clear from all of our briefs that our position is that the suspension clause, that Boumediene held that the suspension clause applies at Guantanamo, and that the due process clause simply can't be distinguished from the suspension clause. In fact, historically, the two rights are intertwined. As Justice Scalia...
Well, then why isn't your argument couched in terms of what process the suspension clause requires? That we have not decided. And the Supreme Court said that the suspension clause requires something.
Right. We're aware that in COSIM, when the panel remanded to the district court for further consideration of the procedural issue at stake there, that the remand was to look at whether or not either constitutional provision had an impact on that question.
Right. So just as your procedural due process questions. Mm-hmm. Are you arguing procedural due process because you don't think the suspension clause requires the heightened standard of review, the ban on hearsay, or banning the presumption of regularity?
I think the problem that we have is that the various procedural cases that Judge Leon cited in that long footnote, including the 2013 appeal in this case, Al-Oda, Latif, Al-Dahi, and Behani, that those cases were essentially argued as suspension clause cases. The dictum in Kiemba was being treated as authoritative by the district courts, at least after February 2009, I think, when it came out. And by and large, counsel were not making due process arguments to this court. I also think, the due process standards are a lot more familiar. We have obviously more case law from the Supreme Court about them to guide us, whereas with the suspension clause, we really...
Well, it might be an easier job for attorneys, although maybe not given circuit precedent, but the question is, the Supreme Court has said you have to have a meaningful opportunity to present habeas corpus, and you have to be able to create the type of record that allows a court to act in a meaningful way, right? We're not potted plants in this process. We're an independent branch that has to be able to make an independent judgment for the habeas corpus writ to mean anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I will say this. Obviously, at some level, we agree with you. We think the process that's been provided thus far is not meaningful, particularly.
Is your argument a categorical? One, is it a categorical ban? You think the suspension clause includes a categorical ban on the use of hearsay? Or I didn't understand you were making an as-applied argument as to something that happened in Mr. Ali's case.
Sure.
And my same question for the presumption against regular, mm-hmm. presumption of regularity.
Yeah, sure. As to hearsay, we think the due process clause cases, particularly Gagnon and Morrissey, that you cite in your opinion in COSIM, mandate.
It's an opinion of the court, just to be clear.
Hmm?
It's an opinion of the
yes,
court.
Yes, of course. That they bar unreliable hearsay and that they require confrontation where feasible. That didn't happen here. To step back in time.
I just wanted a more straightforward answer, if you wouldn't mind my question. Are you arguing that hearsay is categorically barred in all of these, only talking about detainee cases in Guantanamo, that either the due process clause or the suspension clause categorically bars?
Even the federal rules of evidence don't categorically bar it. We would argue that that the standard
categorically
that's
bars
used...
something that the federal rules of evidence treat as inadmissible mm-hmm. hearsay. I'm not talking about the exceptions here.
Sure. We would argue that application of the rules that are as they're set forward in the federal rules is perfectly acceptable. That's what we generally argue for.
So your argument is that the suspension clause or procedural due process clause requires, in all cases, as to all forms of evidence, compliance with the federal rules of evidence?
Not the due process clause per se, but we think that the process that's required by the due process clause is similar. Again, in the sense that unreliable hearsay should not be admitted, and that some degree of confrontation of evidence, particularly where you're talking about testimony.
Your brief just talks about hearsay as sort of this category, and I'm not sure. I mean, unreliable hearsay is might very much be in the eye of the beholder. I'm just trying to really understand what you're asking of this court, because before we can know
sure.
what a panel can do or what we would have to have an on-bank court do, I have to know what, I at least have to know exactly what you're asking for.
Yeah. And maybe it would be helpful if
admitting my confusion.
Yeah, if I step back and just describe the process as it applies here. So.
No, I don't want to understand the Guantanamo. I think I know about the process. What I'm trying to understand is Mr. Ali's position that the Constitution forbids the use of hearsay that would not otherwise be admissible under the federal rules of evidence? Yes or no?
I would say yes. I would say that our position is that that when the government is, for instance, which is the most frequent case, trying to introduce an interrogation record from another detainee, that there must be some evidence regarding the circumstances under which the evidence was, under which the interrogation was made, that would tend to prove that the interrogation is reliable. I think that's what the federal rules would ask for. That's not what we have here. Judge Leon admitted everything whole cloth. The government conceded that reliability should be, that only reliable hearsay should be admissible, but argued that that should be evaluated on a totality of the evidence, as they put it in this case below, meaning you take all of the stories that are in all of these interrogation records and things like the diary that are even more mysterious hearsay, and if they match, then that itself serves as corroboration. And that's what we think is impermissible here.
Mr. Ali is illustrative of a problem, but you're asking for a broader rule.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is a paradigmatic case where a whole bunch of unreliable hearsay, again, four detainees, all of whom had credible torture or abuse allegations, plus a diary where no one knows who wrote it. The original has never been produced in Arabic. It's not clear whether an adult wrote it or a child, and everybody referred to it is referred inside this diary is referred to by a pseudonym. Those are the crucial pieces of evidence that push this case over the preponderance threshold in Judge Kavanaugh's, then Judge Kavanaugh's view. And as Judge Edwards put it, marked Ali for a life sentence. And we think that's just unacceptable under the Due Process Clause.
There's reference here to prior circuit precedent, but do you not have a law of the case problem?
I don't think we do. I mean, I think this really gets down to a question of whether or not there's res judicata in executive detention habeas cases. And we think that Schlup v. Dello, if I'm pronouncing that right, and McCleskey v. Zant say that there isn't. The doctrine of not being able to kind of, or having stricter limitations on second successive petitions that comes out of the collateral review habeas, that's kind of a much more modern invention. Does that make sense?
No one's talking about sort of AEDPA limitations in this context. It's really just a question of, even the argument about indefinite suspension was addressed, and changing sort of the standard of proof was addressed in your prior appeal here. And rejected.
The standard of proof, certainly. But again, everyone treated that, at least at the district court level, where these things were first presented, as being kind of, or the district courts treated the issue as being kind of bound by Kiemba, by the dictum. And I think that foreclosed these arguments from being presented at the district courts and then
this
raised on appeal.
This court in the prior appeal by your client didn't say its hands were tied by Kiemba. It went through the arguments and said, the law of war allows detention until the end of hostilities. That could be an extremely long period of time. But, I mean, that's what the opinion says as I read it.
Right. I think that given the circumstances, perfectly reasonable for Ali to present this argument now. I mean, frankly, he presented it in January 2018, and so did 10 other detainees, and none of those cases have been acted on, because the district courts assumed that they were foreclosed. In fact, there hasn't been action in those 10 other cases and a number of others raising similar arguments to others that I know of since the Cosme opinion came out. In fact, even since the denial of en banc came out. So the district courts in this district clearly are waiting for a ruling from this court on this issue. And in fact, the government, I believe, suggested in a mandamus case from one of Judge Sullivan's cases, where the same motion was filed, that this case might resolve the issue.
What do you conceive of as your burden
to show as to qualify you for your client for relief?
So again, I think, you know, in that roadmap at the outset, there are essentially kind of three different routes to relief. I mean, the first is the shocks the conscience, the substantive due process argument. I wouldn't have a whole lot to say about that. You know, it's the argument is basically that he's simply been held too long without charge, and that compels release, and the government has offered no limiting principle that will ensure that he won't die at Guantanamo. We think that shocks the conscience. In a colloquial sense, all I'll say about the standard is that in County of Sacramento versus Lewis, the Supreme Court made it clear that government action doesn't have to be quote-unquote barbaric or quote-unquote uncivilized, that it can also be utterly arbitrary and purposeless. And so
What I'm driving at is it seems to me that your argument here would give the detainees in Guantanamo a looser standard to get relief than a prisoner in the United States convicted after a criminal jury trial.
That last word is the distinguishing factor. Convicted after a trial, these individuals haven't been charged. He's
governed,
not going to.
If you were governed by 2244, for example, which is the federal habeas corpus statute, you'd have to show, it would be up to you, it would be your burden to show by clear and convincing evidence that your client was actually innocent. That but for the constitutional error, that your client would have been acquitted. Mm-hmm. Now, you're not, the government challenged you in their brief to make that showing, and your reply brief doesn't do it. Mm-hmm.
It's clear, I think, from Hamdi and from Boumediene that the burden in these cases where there's no charge and no trial is on the government. And what that burden consists of is you know what I'd like to touch a little bit on in terms of our other substantive due process claim, which is the one that comes out of the civil commitment cases.
How can you make such a claim in light of Kayemba? Kayemba held clearly that the due process clause does not apply to Guantanamo, and the opinion by Judge Millett in Qasem said that that only means the substantive due process. Mm-hmm. Now you're saying you can mount a substantive due process claim. I don't understand how.
I think I read Judge Millett's opinion for the court in Qasem as a little bit more narrowly than that. I read it as saying, first of all, that procedural due process isn't touched in any way by the statement.
No, but
in
it
Kima,
is by People's Mujahideen and Jeffrey.
Well, again, those aren't detainees who are held in a place that is the functional equivalent of the United States. Again, to address your initial question, my reading of the holding of Kayemba is that Kayemba is fundamentally an immigration case, that given the plenary power of the political branches over immigration, there is no constitutional provision that trumps that, right? That there is, or as I think Judge Pillard put it at argument in Qasem, there's no liberty interest that a detainee has given the robust power of the political branches over immigration, that in the facts of Qasem would somehow
you
trump.
Call it an immigration case, call it what you want. The holding of the case is that the due process clause doesn't apply to Guantanamo.
Respectfully, I think that's far broader than one needs to read the holding in order to make sense of it. I don't think
Judge Millett also agreed with that, the proposition that I just stated in her concurring opinion in Ballou.
There are a number of cases that this circuit has issued over the opinions that this circuit has issued over the years that cite the Kayemba dictum, and we address all of those in our briefs. Our view is that in none of those cases is the citation to the Kayemba dictum anything but dictum itself. Just as the notion in Verdugo-Urquidez that Eisentrager emphatically rejected the application of due process is also dictum in that case. Just as Mazet doesn't apply.
What is dictum in Eisentrager?
In Verdugo-Urquidez, Justice Rehnquist's statement that the Supreme Court emphatically rejected the application of due process. You'll know this from our briefs, but in our view, Eisentrager is very easily distinguishable in this case. It may still be good law for military conviction, military commission convicts who are held at Landsberg Prison in Bavaria. But as to Guantanamo, the Supreme Court has twice ruled that it doesn't control, again, for all these practical reasons, that the place Guantanamo effectively belongs to the United States, that extends the implied protection of the United States to it, as Justice Kennedy said in Rasool, that we're answerable to no other sovereign. And I want to be clear that what we're asking for here today in terms of substantive and procedural due process rights for our clients doesn't necessarily apply to any other territory where the United States may hold prisoners. Whether that's Bagram, whether it's a military prison in Diego Garcia, wherever. What we're asking for is a very limited ruling that's particular to this one peculiar place that is under our permanent control.
What's the difference between Guantanamo and Bagram?
Well, I believe this court spelled some of it out in its Macaulay opinion. But it's fundamentally about the lease.
Both are military bases. Both are on lease from a foreign government. Neither one is within the sovereign territory of the United States.
Yep.
And we've held that you can't, that there's no due process rights in Bagram.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, it's the I think what the two Supreme Court opinions, Rasool and Boumediene, would hold there is that it's down to the terms of the lease. Bagram is not under a permanent lease to the United States.
Not Woodhull, they did hold.
Yes. Sorry.
But I have a question on your, much of your argument is about, you know, how long the detention has gone on here. I'm trying to understand how that would factor into protection under the suspension clause or due process clause. And in particular, I assume you would agree if this had been sort of a more traditional war, and unfortunately was still dragging on after 18 years, there would be no constitutional right to release.
I think that's right. And
so
how I would
how is the fact that this is not a traditionally structured war, but no one disputes, I tell you, you don't dispute either, that it's ongoing, how would that change the constitutional calculus?
Right. I think, from my way of thinking, when you say traditional war, that's an international armed conflict, a conflict between state parties where there is another side that can surrender.
I'm just testing this principle of the law of war. The principle of law of war, right, and as we said in the prior Ali case, principle of law of war is that you can detain people captured on the battlefield until the end of hostilities. This court has said that. And I didn't take your brief to dispute that international law principle. And instead sort of to argue about, well, this is a different type of war, and it's harder to know when it ends, but no one's arguing that it's ended. You're not arguing that it has ended, are you? I didn't see that in your brief. Anyway.
No, although, you know, we have argued elsewhere. And
I don't want to know what you argued elsewhere. You're not arguing in this case that the war has ended.
Right.
And so why would the Constitution have one answer for a traditional war and a different answer for a non-traditional war? Do you have any authority for that?
Well, one thing that we like to cite for this is Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Rasool, where he says at page 488, as the period of detention stretches from months to years, the case for continued detention to meet military exigencies becomes weaker. That's not something that one would ever say in a conventional war where, when we talk about the conflicts that animated the development of the law of war, nowadays that's World War II, basically, right? Right before the modern Geneva Conventions were drafted. And there you have state parties that can surrender to each other and there's a defined end. You also have uniformed armed forces where if someone is released back to their home country, one can assume maybe that they will be drafted and put back.
Do you have any principle of even international law that adopts your position? I didn't see it again in your brief.
Yeah, we haven't cited any of that here on appeal. So
you haven't cited them or you're not aware of them?
There's obviously a lot of debate over what
no
kind of standards
rule of
ought to apply, yes.
The law of war. There's no settled law of war rule that says when hostilities are continuing, but it's harder to tell when they end, that this principle of detention changes?
I think there's an awful lot of academic debate, including from the authoritative sources like the Red Cross, about what should apply in a non-international armed conflict, which this, at best, clearly is.
So I guess one question I have then is, when Congress in 2012 reaffirmed, basically, the authorization and at least implicitly talked about that extended to the authorization to detain, why is that not an indication by Congress that only takes you back 7 years, 6 years, where at least Congress has viewed that the same rules should continue to apply in what you're describing as an unconventional war?
I mean, I think that last sentence is a fair summary of it. I think our view of the 2012 AUMF is that it does nothing but maintain the status quo, and I think that it does nothing but maintain the status quo.
But the status quo is that Congress is authorizing the president to continue to detain. That's what I'm focusing on. To the extent you're talking about substantive due process and shocks to conscience, well, in 2012, even though all this time had passed, and going back even to Hamdi, where Justice O'Connor talked about, well, maybe after 10 years or so, we need a reevaluation. Well, I thought, isn't that the reevaluation by Congress?
Well, you know, again, that's the statute. I don't think Congress necessarily has the last word here, especially given...
No, I understand
given,
that,
you know,
but I'm just trying to understand your shock the conscience notion and following up on what principles are you relying on?
Sure. I think in terms of shock the conscience, it's the arbitrary nature of it, the fact that there doesn't appear to be any particular purpose.
Well, I have another question then. When President Obama gave his speech about the types of people being held at Guantanamo, there were basically those three categories. Mm-hmm. Those, and this goes way back, obviously, but those that they were holding for trial in Article III courts, those that they were holding for military commission proceedings, and then there were groups of people for whom they had no evidence, but they still thought it was necessary to hold. Now, is your client in the latter?
So the task force in 2009 designated our client, along with I think pretty much everybody else who was arrested on that day in the two house raids in Faisalabad, for prosecution. But there's never been any movement whatsoever to charge him. A number of other individuals.
No, I understand that, but I'm trying to draw a distinction where at least, and I don't know, the current administration may have changed this, but I haven't seen anything yet. Where there were these three categories. Now we've moved beyond the Article III issue, but is your client one of the detainees who, for whom the government has no evidence, but still thinks it's necessary to detain? I just wasn't clear.
Sure, he's not cleared for release, let's put it that way. So there are certain individuals.
But he could be one for whom the government has evidence, but for whatever reason, hasn't gotten around to charging yet.
I think that's extremely unlikely to be the case here. I think the universe of the nine people who are in the commission process right now, including two who are convicted, and potentially three others, that's the entire universe of people who are likely to be charged. Of course, anything.
Your brief acknowledges that, what was it, two of the people here have been released.
I'm sorry, two of the people who filed this motion, the motion was filed in 11 different cases, are cleared for release. That's right. And we think those are paradigmatic cases of arbitrary, purposeless detention. Again, on our...
No, but if they're cleared for release, whether they've been actually physically released, I understand it's a different issue. But what I'm trying to get at is the process is not entirely static.
That's true. Are you referring to the periodic review board process that takes another look at these clients?
Well, but you say that's useless. But my point is, at least as to some detainees, there is relief in the sense they are cleared.
They are cleared, but I think the fact that they're still at Guantanamo, in some cases I believe we've got people who are, there's at least one person who was cleared by the task force, so he's been there for 10 years without release. Again, the decision to clear someone is like a decision that comes out of the Periodic Review Board, entirely a discretionary matter.
It's well, I guess executive. What I was trying to understand is when you're talking about shock the conscience, going way back to Hamdi, which of course was a U.S. citizen, the court talked about, well, there ought to be some procedures, and then you have Rasool saying, and Congress ought to provide those procedures, and then Congress comes up with the Military Commissions Act, and then it amends it later on. So Congress has been dealing with procedures, and I understand your point about Congress is not the last word, but to get to a shock the conscience, I'm just concerned about to what extent you can meet that burden here.
So Congress has provided a procedure for trying people by military commission. In fact, when the government argues against the application of the due process clause in the commissions, it says that Congress has provided the process that's due through that act. But there's nothing else out there that governs the treatment or the outcome from Congress for people who are not charged, right?
Seems
the DTA
your
process.
Claim, your claim. This Rochin versus California shocked the conscience. But your claim is essentially cruel and unusual punishment, but you don't want to invoke the Eighth Amendment because that's too big of a bone to chew. So, but I don't understand. Are you asking for a new trial? Is that what you're asking for?
I think the process that we had envisioned in front of Judge Leon was a decision about the due process clause applying and the implications of that for procedures, and then yes, another look at the initial evidence. As my colleague who argued it said at the tail end of that argument, that we'd have to take another look at the initial basis for detention, applying standards that are consistent with procedural due process. Again, those hearsay protections, and at this stage, the clear and convincing evidence standard. And
sorry,
to return
clear
to
clear and convincing evidence of what? I'm not clear then what you're, I thought.
Well, the initial legal standard that's applied is whether or not the person was part of or supporting a group associated with the targets of the
right.
AOMF, something roughly like right. that.
So you want to revisit that question?
We would, right. Again, without.
You're not asking for a changed question.
Well, we are under our substantive due process argument, right? Based on.
Well, you're not claiming the procedural due process requires a different question at this stage.
Even if the result of this appeal is that only the procedural due process clause protections apply, we have argued below that that we're entitled to another look at the evidence that underlay that initial determination that he was detainable.
Did you ask Judge Leon to, in addition to looking again at the old question?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ask Judge Leon to separately inquire whether whoever has the burden of proof, there is an ongoing risk that Mr. Ali would take up arms against the United States?
That's right. That's part of that substantive due process inquiry. And it's the
Did
one
you
that
you asked Judge Leon to make that specific ruling?
Most of the argument touched on this notion from the civil commitment.
I don't want to
touch
on a notion. Is there, where can you point me in the record to where you specifically said, Judge Leon, we need a ruling on that?
Maybe we can get up for a rebuttal.
Okay,
I can find you something in there. But that is our position, that the civil commitment cases demand an inquiry that is, that among other things asks that question, right? So we believe that that inquiry, that the government basically can't justify detention solely by past conduct, that present conditions must connect the continued detention of someone like Ali to a present purpose of allaying an articulable
danger. That's what I'm trying to figure out, how that test works. All right, so you. Let's assume, because I know y'all disagree, let's assume in a hypothetical detainee, there's really strong evidence that this person was involved in training for terrorist activities and in deep with high-level terrorist officials. And so that finding is made. And shortly thereafter, that person is detained before they actually even execute any acts of terrorism or violence against the United States, they're detained.
Mm-hmm.
And 15 years go by. I don't understand how we how that question of whether they're likely, to, if released, to resume fighting against the United States gets answered honestly, because for 15 years they won't have done anything, but that's because they've been in detention. So I don't, I'm not sure if we, even if the question is changed,
I think
you have all the procedure that you want, and you've got powerful evidence on the front end, and hostilities are ongoing. How is someone supposed to
meet that test? You know, again, compare it to those civil commitment cases where someone may have committed a violent crime and is acquitted by reason of insanity.
No, right? they can get treatment for mental health issues. Mm-hmm. No one's suggesting that you're treated for terrorist inclinations.
Well, look, I think, you know, our position is that the government would have to articulate.
What evidence do you have that if one were, and I know you dispute it, but if one were to credit the initial determination, to credit our prior opinion as well, which affirmed it, that he, in fact, was involved in training and preparing for hostilities against the United States? And the only argument I saw in your brief is that he's now 48.
49.
Okay.
I think that kind of argument based on
Laden
age.
Was in his 50s when he died, so.
Yeah. I think
it seems young to me now, the 40s.
to me also.
So is that it?
Well, no. I mean, first of all, some detainees will have arguments that are very clearly premised on age and infirmity.
Right.
For our client, first of all, you know, the allegations against him again are very thin, right? The claim is essentially in terms of training, taking an English class, right, and then some disputed things that come out of interrogation records of him or others that are you know.
Well,
all...
normally on appeal, we would view the evidence most favorably to the government. So your take is it's thin. The government presumably is going to argue, well, if you look at everything, it's not that thin.
Mm-hmm. Right. And again, that's something that we can test on the procedural due process end. The way we would imagine this working on substantive due process, again, modeled on the civil commitment cases, is that the government would have to come forward with an argument about the purpose served by continued detention. Now, if that purpose is that, for instance, Mr. Ali not rejoin the Abu Zubaydah force, which is the finding out of Judge Kavanaugh's opinion, then I think, you know, a number of things flow from that, right? We've got to, first of all, figure out, does this force still exist? Did it cease to exist on that day when those two houses
Why?
Were raided in Faisal Abad?
If somebody wants to fight against the United States in your irregular war here, not yours, as you reference, as you describe it, the irregular war here, I'm sure they can find another group to join up with.
Of course, but that's similar to the argument in the civil commitment cases and the various ones related to mental disorders, that a person is generically dangerous, right? The court asked for more in all of those cases that, you know, typically maybe there'll be some initial act.
Well, I thought the purpose of these periodic reviews was for the government to decide whether it was necessary to continue to hold this particular detainee. Am I correct about that?
That is sort of the premise.
I mean, sort of. I thought that was the purpose of the review.
That is the premise of the periodic review board and what it does. But, you know, again, I think what's problematic about it is, first of all, it's not a judge doing it.
It's an executive official. I understand that. But I'm still saying, just so I understand, the system as it's set up now at least has a premise, as you put it, that there will be these periodic reviews by the executive branch to determine whether it is necessary to continue to hold someone who is at Guantanamo.
Right, and that's determined based on a whole set of procedures that apply in those boards that come nowhere close to complying with procedural due process or what those...
Well, what are those procedures?
Sure. Well, fundamentally, the periodic review board process is a discretionary process, right? I mean, there is a panel,
Right. Does the detainee get to submit anything?
I'm sorry?
Does the detainee get to submit any pleadings or...
Yes. If the detainee has counsel can bring in evidence from the outside.
Right.
But it's fundamentally problematic in this respect. The dossier that is given to the board to review consists of a whole bunch of single-sentence statements that are essentially kind of single-sentence summaries of the exhibits in the habeas returns, but the board doesn't see the underlying return. And there's no other information about the conditions under which most of those things, which are interrogation records, were taken. That, as the Human Rights First Covington amicus ably demonstrates, opens a door to torture evidence, and that's a big issue here. Again, the four key witnesses that the government relied on initially in the district court, all torture victims. Torture, frankly, is a bigger issue now at Guantanamo than it's ever been because 27 out of the 40 remaining detainees have spent some time in CIA custody.
Is your client, was torture evidence introduced against your client?
Well, again, so the four detainees.
Your client.
Yes, the interrogation records from four detainees were introduced. Judge Kavanaugh said that he wasn't relying on two of them. That's Al-Madwani, ISN 839, and yeah. Nur Uthman Muhammad, ISN 707. But there are two whose evidence was relied on, both below and on appeal, who have significant claims about coercion. Jibran al-Qahtani, that's 696, and Binyam Muhammad, 1458, who was notoriously rendered and had his genitalia cut with a razor as an interrogation technique. So those are the kind of things that can get into, right back into the evidence in the periodic review board. But I think one final thing to mention about it is that the board process really ends up turning on environmental factors that are entirely outside of a detainee's control, things like family support. And I'll give you an example right from this case. Ali had one hearing in 2016 before the board in which he participated, but the board said in denying clearance that it wanted more information from the government of Algeria. There is some sort of spat between the two governments, I think, about detainee repatriation, the details of which are completely obscure to us, but there's another cleared Algerian who at the last minute wasn't sent home, and I suspect that is ultimately what cost Mr. Ali a clearance there. His facts, I think, are clearly a notch lower on the scale of interest to the U.S. government than that other Algerian detainees. So again, an entirely discretionary process with no judge there and evidentiary rules that don't come anywhere close to meeting what happened in the district courts up to this date and certainly not compliant with procedural due process.
Why don't we hear from the government?
Thank you.
May it please the court, Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice for the government. Petitioner seems to be making essentially two main constitutional arguments, each of which is wrong, and I'd like to just take a couple of minutes to walk through each of them and explain why each fails. First, petitioner argues that as a matter of substantive due process, he should be released because the length of his detention pending active hostilities has been too long. And notably, I want to be clear, as he was this morning, he is not disputing that active hostilities continue. He is not disputing that Congress has, both in the AOMF and then again a decade later in the NDAA, authorized the government to detain Guantanamo detainees until the end of hostilities. We also know from Hamdi that for people with due process rights, for a U.S. citizen in the United States, the due process clause permits the detention of an enemy combatant pending active hostilities. So we really see no legal basis for circumscribing that detention authority at some arbitrary point.
In the government's view, there would be no limit on the length of time if the war on terror is not officially declared over by the president?
Well, I want to be clear. There is no dispute here that the conflict in Afghanistan continues in essentially the same way, form, nature.
No, I understand your argument in that regard. I just want to be clear what the government's position is.
I don't think the question is presented by this case.
So the government has no position it wishes to share.
We are not taking a position on that issue.
Thank you.
I think our position is a very clear one, that when active hostilities continue against Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces in Afghanistan, and according to the most recent report to Congress, from the Department of Defense in June 2019, there were 14,000 military personnel on the ground in Afghanistan.
But what I'm getting at is, from time to time, administrations have said, either we've won, or we're winning, or we're entering into negotiations. And that, it seems to me, those types of situations could be periods when to talk about a war actively continuing has a different type of meaning. And I'm just wondering whether when the Supreme Court has talked about the need for periodic reevaluations after a length of time, whether that's the thing it may have had in mind, whether you want to call it substantive or procedural.
Well, I would say this. I think this court in Al-Alwi adopted a framework for deciding whether hostilities are ongoing. And that framework envisioned a circumscribed role for this court. And I would note the petitioner has not challenged that that is the appropriate framework for purposes of this case.
That's why I asked you hypothetically.
Yeah. Here, the executive has told the court that active hostilities are gone, and there is no contrary indication.
Prisoners being held at Landsberg in Bavaria, in the Eisentrager case, Germany surrendered in 1945. Eisentrager was decided in 1950. Those prisoners were still in the Landsberg prison. So one could say that hostilities had ended for 5 years.
And we're not taking a position on whether there would be some wrapping up period. I think our position is pretty clear and pretty narrow because of the narrowness of the issue as it's been framed for this court to decide. It's simply that where there is no question that hostilities continue in essentially the same form as this court recognized just a year ago in Al-Alwi.
Of course, in that case, the court acknowledged that there has to be a period of time, you know, is to figure out what you're going to do with these prisoners.
Correct.
All right. So that was the nature of the continued detention, as I recall.
I just don't think that question is presented here, and our point is simply the basic one, that the government shouldn't be required to release an enemy combatant simply because, you know, enemy forces have extended the conflict by continuing to fight. And then if I can turn to the second main constitutional argument we understand.
So the argument is, so long as the United States decides it's necessary to at least have troops on the ground, the war is continuing.
I think when the war is continuing in essentially the same form and nature that confronted this court just a year ago in Al-Alwi, and frankly with troop numbers that are...
I know, I'm trying to understand what we're talking about, okay? That's why I'm asking you these questions. I understand the words, all right? But that is basically the government's position. If the commander-in-chief decides we need troops on the ground, the war is continuing.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is our position. And then if we can turn to the procedural due process question, that argument seems to boil down to the position that in light of the duration of detention here, procedural due process requires a heightened standard of proof and renders unconstitutional other procedures used to adjudicate his habeas petition. Again, you know, Hamdi held that for a U.S. citizen held as an enemy combatant in the United States, due process procedural protection should take into account the circumstances of the unique nature of the detention here, and in particular, the interest of the military in not having its battlefield commanders dragged into court or being forced to search for evidence as they're carrying out combat operations.
I guess what has me a bit confused is 2008, the Supreme Court said that enemy combatants or detainees at Guantanamo are entitled to whatever procedures are required to allow meaningful opportunity to file a writ of habeas corpus and to create the type of record that allows a court to act as a court and provide meaningful review of the detention decision. And in all this interim time, no one has told me, so I would really like to know the United States government's view. Under the suspension clause, as analyzed in Boumediene, or under your brief on page 37, when you reference those fundamental rights recognized at the founding, what procedures do you agree do apply?
So I think we would look to Hamdi as setting out a guidepost for what those procedures could be, should be, and Boumediene itself, obviously, if one assumes without deciding that due process were to apply, and I think this court doesn't need to reach that question to decide the question of whether he has made out a viable constitutional procedural due process claim. I think a detainee would need to have the opportunity to submit exculpatory information in his own defense, to put on his own evidence or any new evidence found or acquired since the government had made some initial detention decision. The court, some independent court, would have an opportunity to review the basis for detention and whatever information the detainee had put forward.
Do they have a right to get exculpatory information from the government?
Certainly we have afforded detainees that
I'm
right
I'm asking
here.
Whether you think I'm asking you the constitutional question because you have a line in your brief that they get these fundamental, you're talking about procedural rights here, fundamental rights recognized at the time of the founding as part of the common and statutory law redressable through a habeas petition. So what are, that's it? They just get to put on evidence?
So I'm not authorized to take a position on whether there would be a suspension clause right to exculpatory discovery from the government. I would say that we have provided that discovery.
No, but you have a line in your brief here that they get those fundamental rights. You just didn't tell me what they are. So
right.
I'd like to, the fundamental right, as far as you're concerned, the only one that you'll recognize, you'll admit to, is that they have a right to put on whatever evidence they happen to have?
I think it would be an issue to be litigated were this court not sitting as a panel bound by its prior decisions. We're simply preserving that argument.
Is there
for
a prior decision of this
review.
Court addressing what procedures are available under the suspension clause under Boumediene?
Well, I don't understand counsel for petitioner to be arguing on the basis of suspension clause procedures this morning.
You had the line in your brief that you would that those are the procedures they would get, but then never. So it seems like you thought the issue was worth pointing out to us that there's something they should get, but you're not going to tell us.
So I think our issue is a little bit narrower, if I may, Your Honor. I think our point is that to the extent a court were to hold that due process applies at Guantanamo, to the extent the court is applying the suspension clause and the due process clause together, I think we would argue that the right of suspension clause recognized in Boumediene does not entail the full scope of statutory habeas review that has developed in the modern era. For example, conditions of confinement claims.
If it depends on the scope of the writ of habeas corpus in 1789.
That's correct. Our position at the end of our brief is I want to be clear, a narrow one.
And that can't possibly encompass the due process clause because Congress did not, or the Bill of Rights was not adopted until 1791. So if you're looking at the habeas corpus statute as it existed at the time it was incorporated into the, or not statute, but the habeas corpus writ, then it has to be something other than the due process clause.
Yes, that is our position, Your Honor.
That's your position? I didn't think the due process clause dropped from heaven. I thought itself was capturing traditional common law notions of process. Is
and
that
again,
right?
I don't think the court needs to reach this issue to resolve petitioner's claim, but our position, yes, is that Boumediene spoke to the extraterritorial reach of the suspension clause and the suspension clause alone, that it was framed and limited by the unique role that that clause plays in our structural separation of powers, that the suspension clause was obviously made a part of our constitutional framework at a time when there was no Bill of Rights, and that Boumediene should not be understood to apply to other constitutional provisions.
But to be clear, in the 11 years, the government hasn't since come up with its own list other than they get to put on evidence of what that requires. I don't know how they could be litigating all these cases without having its own idea
we
of what the Supreme
position,
Court
Your
requires.
Honor, as to what procedures might be constitutionally applied if a court were to hold that the Due Process Clause
no,
applies
I'm
at
asking you, in the wake of Boumediene, which was quite explicit
because
about
I want to
a source
be...
of procedural protections distinct from or maybe overlapping with, because there certainly were connections there to the due process clause. And so it's certainly thought there's some aspects of procedural due process that are, in fact, essential to a meaningful opportunity to challenge detention and a meaningful opportunity for court to provide review. But there's still, I'm just a bit baffled. Well, I don't know why nobody will address the question the Supreme Court teed up.
I think the government has adjudicated these cases under procedures that are fully protective of detainees' rights, and so it has not been necessary. Just as this court in Al-Bahani, for example, assumed that a preponderance standard would be constitutionally lawful without deciding whether that would be constitutionally required. And of course, the detainees in these proceedings are given notice and opportunity to be heard, the provision of exculpatory discovery, et cetera. And as we know,
in which proceedings, just so I'm clear,
in the adjudication of their habeas proceedings,
right, yeah,
as was the case in Mr. Ali's prior proceeding, in which there was a full trial, he put on evidence, the government put on evidence, and the district court found overwhelming evidence that he was lawfully detained, which this court, of course, affirmed, and he has not, in fact, challenged in
how
this
did
proceeding.
How did the government establish that he was at a four-room, whatever? Safe house or whatever they call it.
Thank you for asking,
yes,
Your Honor. And I just, if I can just begin by pointing out something that I'm struggling with a little bit today. Counsel for petitioner stood up, disclaimed any interest in making an as-applied constitutional challenge, and nowhere in the briefing in this case, until perhaps the reply brief, did he identify any specific aspect of the prior trial proceeding and evidence that somehow would be violative. And yet, you know, he has just stood up here and discussed a variety of largely classified.
I'm just asking you, he spent 18 days in this whatever guest house.
As this court previously found,
yeah,
the bulk of evidence against him was in fact undisputed. He did not dispute. He was discovered in a four-room safe house. He was captured along with Abu Zubaydah and 10 members of his senior members of his force, you know, explosives expert, terrorist training camp trainers. When he was captured, it was undisputed
and
that he had been there for
the common area of the house. The common area of the house contained the makings of bombs, right?
Bomb materials, Al-Qaeda propaganda. He had been there approximately 18 days. It was undisputed that all of that had happened. The district court also found that he had admitted to an FBI agent shortly after his detention that he had gone to Afghanistan after 9/11 to fight U.S. and coalition forces. The court found that Abu Zubaydah was also fighting in Afghanistan before fleeing with his terrorist force to that safe house where they were all captured. While at the Pakistan guest house, Ali underwent terrorist training by taking English lessons, and there was evidence that Zubaydah's force was planning to infiltrate English-speaking areas to carry out terrorist attacks. And when he was captured, Ali falsely identified himself and maintained that false cover story for 2 years. You know, this court found that evidence overwhelming, and so
I just have a little fact question. Are guest houses and safe houses the same? Same thing. I take it this isn't a hostel, right?
Correct.
Is this somebody owns a compound and they have rooms? I'm just not sure.
I will be honest with this court. I have not reviewed the classified record of that earlier proceeding because we did not understand him to be challenging, you know, the veracity of that determination. And so I'm a little at odds, but yes, a guest house.
There have been arguments about how one doesn't sort of just trip in here.
Exactly,
confused,
Your Honor.
About the phrase guest house, whether it has a specialized meaning or it's the same as a safe house. Or
no,
a difference.
Those terms are typically used interchangeably. And as this court has in many of its prior Guantanamo decisions recognized, the idea that somebody would be found in a safe house, a guest house, you know, within the close confines of that property with high-level terrorist leaders is extremely implausible.
And I had a question about the presumption of regularity. And not its particular application in this case, but to the extent there's a facial challenge, is that presumption used in detention proceedings as to things like FBI 302 reports?
Cool.
You know, I mean, is that something that's just generally used, at least in the pretrial stage, for detention decisions that you're aware of?
In other contexts?
Yes.
I'm not aware, Your Honor. I will say the presumption that's applied in these detention proceedings is a presumption of accuracy, that an intelligence report or an FBI interrogation report accurately describes what was said. It is not a presumption of correctness. And I would note, in Hamdi, it's not a presumption of truth, that's right. And in Hamdi, the plurality proposed that for a U.S. citizen, due process would allow a presumption applied by a court in favor of the government's
evidence. In response to sort of the facial argument made here, I was trying to understand where else this presumption of regularity is used.
I'm not aware of what we do in those other contexts. But of course, there is a general presumption of regularity that applies to government action, so it wouldn't be in any way surprising. I would also point to the Hamdi plurality's endorsement of the use of hearsay. And, you know, the idea that something more would be required here is, I think, quite problematic. Obviously, in Hamdi, the Supreme Court recognized the unique burdens that these kinds of cases can...
Well, in fairness, I didn't think they were saying you can't use hearsay at all. It's just they want it under the federal rules.
No, well...
Do you think it goes further?
Petitioner's counsel did ask a few minutes ago, if I understood him at podium, for an opportunity to confront witnesses. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously... Part of the problem with this heightened standard over time that he's demanding is it would fundamentally change the way the military would carry out its operations. The military has no way to know at the time it's engaged in combat and picking up a detainee how long that combat is going to last, how long that conflict is going to go on for. That's not something entirely within our control. The enemy does get a vote on that issue. And so it would require, you know, in order to be safe, the kind of evidence gathering and...
Well, you know, we have to be careful here because the administration made a decision not to treat these people as prisoners of war and therefore entitled to the protections under the regulations for prisoners of war.
Well,
so
certainly
they came up with this category of enemy belligerents.
Unlawful enemy combatants. That's correct,
well,
Your Honor.
The terms have changed over time, as Judge Green's opinion points out, and the scope of it has changed. And a definition that sort of says including but not limited to. So it's been very open-ended. That's all I'm getting at.
I just would point to the idea that our ability to gather somehow heightened evidence or more direct testimonial evidence at this point, many years later, is not heightened. And so the idea that this would not have a direct and immediate impact on what the military would have to do sort of at the point of detention is simply not right.
Do you know which category Ali is in?
I do not. Although I would note that the military commission process is ongoing and charges are still being brought against people. Obviously, that
but we don't know whether the government has any evidence against him.
We certainly have evidence against him. That evidence was put before Judge Leon in the earlier.
We know about the safe house.
Right.
But that's it.
I do not know whether there is a basis for or contemplation of the military commission charges.
So we don't know what category he's in.
Well, we certainly know he hasn't been deemed eligible for transfer by the
report. But when an effort was made by the administration to try to figure out what categories of people were being held, there were these three categories. And I'm trying to figure out where this man is, and no one can tell me.
And I don't know that.
Yeah.
So are there?
I mean, suppose, just hypothetically, the government were to concede he was in a safe house, he took English lessons, he was there over 2 weeks, there were leaders of the war on terror in the house, and that's it. And that's many years ago. And the government has no other evidence. Would that make any difference?
So I would add, I think, one critical thing that was maybe missing from that list, which is a determination initially made by the government and then upheld by both the district court and this court that he was part of that terrorist force.
Okay, but what I'm getting at is the government made a determination that it had evidence as to certain people and was ready for trial and it charged them. And sometimes those trials were going to be in a federal court, other times before the military commission. Then there was a group where they had evidence but they hadn't gotten around to charging. Then there was a group where they had no evidence, but they weren't releasing them. I mean, let me put it this way. They may have had evidence, but they didn't have evidence sufficient, in the government's view, to bring charges.
To bring criminal charges. But, of course, the...
Well, to bring charges...
Under the MCA.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
So, I'm just wondering if he's in that category, and if that makes a difference. We used to talk about the shepherd who got swept up in a sweep, you know, sort of thing. Or the mayor of the town who got swept up in a sweep. I'm just trying to understand, where is this man?
So
we don't know, according to the government.
Well, we know he's not someone who has been inadvertently and incorrectly identified as part of a terrorist force that was one of the associated forces fighting against.
I mean, it's like the war on drugs. You know, these couriers, all right, as opposed to the leaders. I'm just trying to understand what the government thinks this man is.
So,
and we don't know, is what you're telling me.
We think he is part of Abu Zubaydah's terrorist force, which it is undisputed.
All you have is that at that time, there was evidence to suggest that he was training to be part of this terrorist force.
And
period.
In our view, that would be the legal basis for his detention.
That's the legal basis for his initial detention. I'm talking about going to trial on charges.
But I would say our ability to hold somebody is not dependent on and does not turn on whether we intend to criminally prosecute.
It makes a difference if the government has absolutely no evidence whatsoever that it thinks is sufficient to place charges against the detainee. And that's what the Attorney General's report to the President identified. And a lot of those people in the third category were being processed for release, rendition, etc. You don't know where this man is.
So we know a few things. We know from Hamdi that the government is not required to criminally prosecute somebody to detain them pending active hostilities.
No, but don't rely on Hamdi, because there the court, the plurality, said, you know, after 10 years, maybe it's time for a reevaluation.
So I don't think that's quite how we understand that decision.
The words are in the opinion itself.
What the plurality recognized was that detention pending hostilities in this kind of irregular conflict might last for a very long time. And what the plurality said is that if the practical considerations, practical circumstances, are entirely unrelated to the nature of conflict that has given rise to the law of war rule that it is lawful to detain pending hostilities, that might pose a different question. And of course, apart from the fact that that is not a controlling opinion of the court.
And after 10 years,
there is
maybe
no,
a reevaluation is called for. Anyway,
I don't understand.
I don't want to debate what is in the language of the Supreme Court opinion. You can both read it. But I'm just getting at, you don't know whether the government has any evidence beyond what it had at the time it initially detained him.
Certainly.
As to whether or not the government has made an evaluation as to whether it has sufficient evidence to bring charges. It just hasn't brought them, but it has evidence to bring them.
That I do not know.
That's
what
right.
I do know is with the evidence that we had before the habeas court and this court, there is a lawful basis for detention, as this court affirmed, and he has not been cleared for release.
I think we're repeating ourselves, yeah. Don't you?
And with that, we would ask the court to affirm.
I just have another quick question. You referenced that he had made a statement that he came to either Afghanistan or the guest house to train to fight against the United States.
That after 9/11, he went to Afghanistan to fight against the U.S. and
has he
forces.
Disavowed that statement? Challenged it under one of his procedural rules?
In the earlier proceeding, he challenged that he was not the person who had made that statement on the basis that the FBI report identified a different safe house as the one in which he had been picked up. but the district court found, and this court affirmed as not being clear error, that that was just a typographical mistake, that all of the other content of the report made it clear that he was, in fact, the declarant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for Mr. Allery.
I'm aware that we took up an awful lot of your time this morning, and thank you for the solicitude. I have, I guess, 7 points, number
well,
one.
Well, we had a lot of questions.
As you should, and thank you for the questions. First, the government in its briefs and today hasn't offered any argument for why it would be impractical and anomalous to apply either the substantive or the procedural protections of the Due Process Clause at Guantanamo. I don't think there is any such argument. Judge Rogers, to your question about whether
wait,
or not...
Wait. I don't hear them conceding that at all, and in fact seem quite clear that there's no way they're ready to move the whole due process truck into this process, and that, in fact,
certainly
the process, even some of the procedural things, I'm just trying to summarize their position, I'm probably not doing it well, but that certainly some of the procedures even would be hard to do given the nature of it. This isn't a...
Sure.
These things aren't roped off as crime scenes with people coming in with gloves on their hands to clean up evidence afterwards.
Yeah. Maybe I should jump to that point then. The government repeatedly cited the military interests that were alluded to in the Hamdi plurality, this notion that you don't want to distract battlefield commanders with the duty of collecting evidence and so forth. I mean, putting to one side what Justice Kennedy said in his Rasul concurrence about the cause for military exigency growing weaker, this was a CIA-led raid in the third most populous city in Pakistan, an hour from the Indian border, nowhere near the conflict in Afghanistan. The FBI was present during the raid in Pakistan. And, as the court said in Boumediene, this conflict lacks any historical parallel, and I think this case is a little bit different, potentially, than some that involve anything resembling battlefield detentions, although, as we know now, very few detainees were actually captured by the United States on battlefields, or on battlefields, for that matter. Judge Rogers, as to your question about whether or not prosecution would happen here, the four detainees I mentioned, whose names are all over the opinions of Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Leon in the first round here, all four have been released. So I think that tells you, while it might be much easier to confront their evidence now that they can be interviewed somewhere outside of Guantanamo by the defense, I think it's highly unlikely that there's going to be a prosecution in this case, where one of the primary allegations seems to be that his training involved taking English lessons.
You keep saying that like it's a little thing, but if I assume they weren't just doing it for the sake of reading English literature, right? They wanted to. The point was they were. The allegations are that there's a reason folks are taught English.
There are many reasons.
It's not to be helpful to the United States.
Yeah, in the subcontinent, there are many, many reasons to learn English. It's the lingua franca.
At this location.
In
he wasn't at the university.
He was in Punjab, where people either speak Punjabi or English. I don't think he speaks either one. Judge Kavanaugh.
He didn't go to the university to learn English, right?
He's got a third grade education. I think it's perfectly reasonable for any person in our world today to want to learn English. But we heard an awful lot briefly there.
Please.
from the government.
You want to lose your credibility?
Yes.
About specific items of evidence that were cited here. And I want to point out again that Judge Kavanaugh said in his opinion that there might be innocent explanations for all of these. He disputed that he was in the particular house with Zubeda. The whole thing about the common area, I don't know if there's anything in the public record about it. There's a long article in Esquire magazine about the prosecution of Nur Uthman Muhammad that talks about how it wasn't public. He disputed that it was...
Well, the government's argument is basically this evidence was undisputed at the time.
He disputed an awful lot of this at the hearing, including that it was him being interrogated.
At which hearing?
At his initial hearing in 2000, in I think December 2010. Disputed
this is
that
in
his,
the habeas proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. He disputed that it was his picture being shown to other detainees. And as to the item that I think Judge Kavanaugh probably found the most convincing back in 2013, the notion that somehow someone doesn't end up as a couch surfer, as he put it, in a guest house, I want to point out that, you know, that CIA-led raid, the person in charge of it wrote a long book about that and his other aspects of his career. And that, along with items in the record, indicate that, for instance, there were a large number of Pakistani nationals in the house who were all turned over to the Pakistanis and by and large released. I want to also point out that
Are you disputing that at the initial detention hearing, preponderance of the evidence was the wrong standard? I thought you were only arguing that for after this long period of time. Are you disputing that?
Well, again,
are you disputing that?
We think that procedural due process requires, at minimum, another shot.
I'm asking a narrower question than that. At the initial detention hearing, preponderance of the evidence was the standard.
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you don't dispute that at that initial hearing, that was the correct legal standard?
At that initial hearing. Well, you know, again,
I'm not talking about now. Talking about when it happened.
I think one could have raised a due process argument, just like we're doing now, back in the even after the Kiemba dictum had come out.
The time that has passed. This whole case you brought now is about the time that has passed.
That's true. And Matthews, I think, is the key to a question I think you had asked Judge Millett at the outset here. Matthews asks us to balance the equities here, the injury, the potential harm to the detainee versus the harm to the government, and ask whether additional procedures will reduce the risk of error. And so that obviously is going to be changed with time.
I'm confused about your position. I had thought that as to the initial detention decision, you weren't disputing preponderance. In this case, I'm not whether someone could. You weren't disputing preponderance of the evidence. Although you're giving us lots of reasons why the evidence could have been looked at differently, that's going to be true in any preponderance case. You weren't disputing that. I had thought your position was, okay, be that as it may, we are now 17 or however many years after his detention, and a decade after his initial detention decision, and now we need to have a heightened standard for continued detention. Am I understanding your position correctly?
That's correct. I think, whatever one might think about the correctness of those decisions, even if a due process challenge had been mounted in 2009, Matthews dictates that as time passes, the injury to the detainee increases. There is no corresponding
And you're not making any argument here that the suspension clause requires these procedures that you're asking for. All I hear you doing is due process.
Yeah, this is a due process challenge here. Does it overlap and parallel what a meaningful process really should be? I think so.
Mm-hmm. I don't know because no one will tell me what the suspension clause requires.
You're correct that we're trying to force a due process decision here. I just have, I think, three more points, hopefully very briefly. I'm sorry about the time. The key thing with the civil commitment modeled substantive due process procedure that we envision is that one can't presume the risk of return. It can't be that Ali is generically dangerous to return to the global jihad. And the second most important point is that we'd get to contradict that. The government would make its assertions about whether or not he's going to return and what particular force it would be, whether there's a beta force still exists, for instance.
How do you prove that someone's going to go back or not after they've been in detention this time?
It's difficult, and that's why it's a clear and convincing statement. Standard in the civil commitment cases rather than beyond a reasonable doubt. Addington versus Texas has a long discourse on this and says...
The assumption is things change over time. And again, if hostilities had stopped, that would be a very important fact, right? No question. But if hostilities are ongoing, Al-Qaeda is ongoing, he hasn't done anything because he's been under lock and key. That's not particularly powerful evidence.
You know, we concede that there may have to be, that this is a predictive judgment. Again, based on Addington, that is why the standard is lower than the criminal standard of proof. Clear and convincing allows some wiggle room for predictive judgment. But we think we should at least be able to respond to whatever they assert the danger is. And the danger can't be so generic as he might join the global jihad somewhere. If we send him back to Algeria, which is fundamentally, kind of one of the most secure countries that we can send Guantanamo detainees back to, where 15 people have been sent and all of them are accounted for and nothing bad has happened, where the police density is the equivalent of Manhattan, one per 200 people, because they went through their own ISIS crisis in the late 90s. If they can come up with an argument for why sending him back there means that there's going to be some risk.
It sounds like you're making an argument that someone else could watch him, which is a very different argument that he is no longer at risk of taking arms against the United States. I don't think you get to argue that, well, the cops will keep an eye on him at home, I would think you would have to show there is no longer, or put aside the burden of proof, which no one has briefed for us here either, but if the government, somehow there'd have to be a determination, a court would have to find that there's no longer, pick your adjective, substantial material risk of taking up against arms against the United States. That's not what you're talking about when you talk about Algeria.
But that's not how we evaluate, for instance, a case of people with antisocial personality disorders.
Because they can be cured.
Not for that bit,
and
I don't
treated.
Think.
I mean, they're talking about curing and treating him.
I'm sorry, I missed
the point is that with proper cure and treatment, they will no longer pose the risk. Your point is a hypothetical person still is breathing fire against the United States, and I think it's, your brief has even said it probably doesn't get better after being in Guantanamo. They're still breathing fire against the United States, but someone else can watch them. I'm not aware of any argument where that's sufficient.
I hope we didn't say anything that mm-hmm. implied that people leave Guantanamo furious at the United States. I've dealt with very many released clients, and they leave broken rather than angry, which is also how I feel after 18 years of this. But I would point you to Salerno among those civil commitment cases, where the inquiry is whether or not there are any conditions of release that can possibly reasonably assure public safety. I don't think this
but
is
that's
a...
that's conditions monitored by the same authority that's detaining them. This is handing it over to someone else. Does that matter or not?
I don't really think it matters that much. I think we can make the same factual inquiries. Again, I think there's got to be wiggle room, and some of that wiggle room may come from the fact that it's a foreign mm-hmm. government. But we also have a very long track record with Algeria. And this is, you know, frankly, the same sort of thing that the PRB asked for, right? They wanted more information about it. It's unclear what that could be.
Given is that proceeding pending?
He had another hearing scheduled in 2018, which he didn't attend out of understandable, I suppose, frustration. I think right now they are probably on an every 2 year.
He had one in June of this year.
Yeah.
He did.
I think maybe what you – I thought it was 2018. I might be
incorrect
about
the – a board proceeding of June 2019.
What they do is every 6 months.
July 2019.
They'll have a file review, which is
they. That's a file review.
Ask for a written submission that mm-hmm. can indicate whether or not another full hearing would be required on something on a shorter basis than the every 3 year thing that's in the regulations or the every 2 year thing that's happening as a matter of practice because there are so few people outside of the commission system who are being reviewed. I'm not entirely sure if I have the date of his second full scheduled hearing, but even if you don't win in the file review process, you'll get another hearing, that's for sure. One last thing maybe, and again, thank you for your solicitude. I just want to say, you know, Judge Edwards described our client's primary sin as having spent 18 days in a guest house, and he will shortly have spent a year in prison for every one of those 18 days, and the government has offered no limiting principles.
He said what?
He has now spent a year. Oh, you're asking me what Judge Edwards said? I'll just say it again.
What
sorry.
Did he say?
Judge Edwards described our client's primary sin as having spent 18 days in a guest house, and our client will shortly have spent a year in prison for every one of those 18 days, and the government offers no limiting principle that suggests that life detention will not happen here as a factual matter. And as a result, going forward, Ali faces a prospect of lifetime detention on no greater evidence than we require to prove negligence in a slip and fall case. And as we said in our briefs, our Constitution demands better of us.
All right, thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.